Church Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my mother and co-host, Caroline Kilborn.
Good morning, everyone. Another beautiful day.
It is. It's a hot summer day, and our book today is set in a cold Chicago winter, so a little bit of a different environment. Our guest today is Tracy Clark, and she is the Sue Grafton Memorial Award-winning author of the highly acclaimed Chicago Mystery Series, featuring ex-homicide cop-turned-PI Cassandra Rains. The protagonist is a hard-driving African-American private investigator who works the mean streets of the Windy City. Now, Tracy received Anthony Award and Lefty Award nominations for her series debut, Broken Places, which also picked up a whole number of other awards. Her second installment in the series, Borrowed Time, was also very well rewarded and awarded. And so I'm guessing this makes this the third in the series. Is that right, Tracy?
Runner is number four.
Runner is number four.
What You Don't See was last year. So far, I'm holding on.
And in addition to her Cass Rains novels, she has written short stories and is a native of Chicago, works as an editor in the newspaper industry, and roots for all the Chicago sports teams. She is a board member at large of Sisters in Crime, Chicagoland, a member of International Thriller Writers, and a Mystery Writers of America Midwest board member. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Tracy.
Well, thank you for having me, Beau.
So what is in your background that led you to write hard-boiled mystery PI novels?
Well, I always knew I wanted to write, so I sort of gravitated to the kinds of stories that I enjoyed reading. I liked the PI story. I liked that sort of character, that sort of outsider character, that sort of broken nose kind of guy who sort of gets in alley fights and gunfights down by the docks. I sort of loved that genre. So when I sort of got to the point where I made up my decision, I'm going to write something like that, but I wanted to put a female character in there. I wanted her to be African-American like I am. I wanted to put myself on the page. And lucky for me, I sort of came after these couple of wonderful waves of female crime writers. Early 80s, we had Sue Grafton and Peretzky and Mueller and Marin. And then in the 90s, we had great wave of African-American crime writers, Valerie Wilson Wesley, Eleanor Taylor Bland, writers like that. So I sort of had that sort of hook to sort of teach me how to do it, to sort of navigate the waters. So it was just a matter of then me sort of teaching myself how to sort of hook into that genre, that sort of storytelling, and to put my character out there.
And did you have family members who were cops or?
Lucky for me, I had again. Lucky, yeah. I have my brother was a cop. My brother-in-law now is a cop. I had an uncle and a cousin who were both police officers. So I started writing this, knowing absolutely nothing about how police actually worked, but you know, hearing the stories of these tales of, you know, just terror that they sort of told around the dinner table, frightening at one point, but also captivating in the other. So I sort of had them to sort of ask if I sort of ran into a problem, who does this or when does that happen and stuff like that. So it was good to have that to sort of ping off of.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense because, you know, also knowing absolutely nothing about how the police really works, it feels to me like you're writing is very authentic, and I have read books sometimes that it's like I think they're just doing their research about how things work on the internet and not actually talking to anybody, you know.
Yeah, and that's where you get the good stuff, the really juicy things.
Yeah,
and in fact,
absolutely.
Early on, I wanted to sort of know what an interview room smelled like. Nobody could tell me, and of course, They're not just going to allow me to just sort of waltz in there and sort of take a whiff. So I had to ask police officers, well, what does it smell like? Well, it smells like sweat and occasionally vomit and all of those wonderful, just really ugly things that you don't want to experience. But that's what the room smells like. And so I wanted to know what it looked like, what kind of table is in there, what kind of chairs. There's a bar, apparently, that runs the length of the thing with where you can sort of hook the handcuffs on. I didn't know that. They had to sort of tell me that. So all of that good information that you sort of need to sort of flesh your story and your character out. And, you know, when I started really sort of revising the first book, knowing that Cass had this background in police work, I sort of took two police detectives, female, to breakfast. And I said, well, exactly how do you do your job? What are the things you worry about? How do you accomplish the same thing maybe your male counterparts do? But, you know, they tell me you have to do it a little differently. They're not as big. They're not as brawny as the men are. And so they have to use their brain and psychology and sort of try to sort of de-escalate situations where nobody gets hurt. They don't get hurt. They get to go home at night. The person that they are handcuffing gets to go to jail unaccosted and in 100% shape. So it's sort of a chess game, right? You sort of have to figure out how to sort of do what everybody else does in a different way. So it was good to have that information.
And did you get some feedback on, like, the TV shows, the Law and Orders, the, you know, CSIs and stuff? How accurate are they really?
Not really. Not really accurate. I think the cops sort of look at cop shows and sort of rolling their eyes and, oh my God, I can't believe that they sort of put that out there. But, you know, it's the same with medical shows and doctors, I think. It's just entertainment is different from the actual real world stuff. So, yeah, they're a little suspicious of it. But, you know, what are they going to do?
Yeah, they don't do too many shows about my line of work, which is accounting. But there was a there was a movie recently where the accountant was like an assassin, I think.
Oh, that's interesting. And he's got your bank records.
Yeah, maybe they should do more. Maybe there should be more.
Come with that, yeah.
Wow. Oh, did we? I want to make sure we actually said the name of the book. So the name of the book is Runner by Tracy Clark, and it's book four in the series Chicago Mystery.
Yeah. Is there another book in progress in this series?
Well, no, in this series, no. We're taking a sort of a short break. I have two standalones that have to come first. The next book up is Hyde, which is my number five. That's a standalone. It's still set in Chicago. Not a PI. This main character is an actual homicide detective, which is sort of Cass's past life. Still African-American, still female, and told from the third-person perspective as opposed to the first. So it's all, again, learning and sort of finding a new way to tell this story with these new cast of characters. So I'm kind of excited about it. I'm one draft in. It's shaping up. I'm a little worried, but I will get there.
Why did you decide to do this and instead of just continuing in the series?
Well, I may continue, but, you know, you just sort of don't want to tell the same story over and over again. It's good to take a break. It's good to find out what else you can do. It's good to sort of expand your understanding of story and plot and pacing and sort of put all those things into a new character and see how far you can go with it. So we'll see how it goes. I'm confident that I can pull it all together before the 1st of December when it is due. And so knock wood that I don't, expire before now and then.
So what's the biggest challenge for you of switching to third person when, you know, you're accustomed to writing in first?
Yeah.
Yeah. So what's the biggest challenge?
Well, Cass's voice was so strong and so clear that sort of switching to third person with somebody new that I'm just now learning about. As I said, I'm one draft in and I'm still trying to figure out who she is and what motivates her. But it is sort of frightening. It's sort of like standing on the side of a mountain and sort of jumping off. You have no idea where you're going to land or if you're going to land or how badly you're going to land. But, you know, it's good. I guess it's good, generally, to sort of challenge yourself and see what else you can come up with. And I am confident, as I said, that before the 1st of December, I will have figured out all the things that I have not yet figured out. So
you're talking about character development, but of course, mm-hmm. in this type of book, plot is king. Mm-hmm. Did you start book one? Did you have the plot concept or did you have the character first?
I had character first. I had her voice in my head first. And I had my genre. I had PI fiction. She's going to be a PI in Chicago. And this is the character that I had to work with. I am a pantser, which means that I don't have like an extensive outline sort of guiding me through. I just sort of sit down and stare at my laptop for a little bit. I have sort of an inkling of an idea of what I think the story is going to be about. But my story, my novel starts when her client walks through her office door. And however I go from there, sort of following the breadcrumbs through this dark and dusky forest until I get to the end. And the good thing about PI fiction is it sort of has a linear pattern to it. You have a case, you have a client, and then you find out how to solve your client's problem. And you go from suspect to suspect, this turn and that turn, until you finally get to the big conclusion at the end, and hopefully your character comes away unscathed.
So at what point do you figure out who done it yourself?
Well, let's see, maybe halfway through, you sort of have an idea of who the bad guy is. With Broken Places, I sort of got halfway through with one bad guy. And then I had sort of a spark of an idea, but wouldn't it be interesting if it turns out to be this one instead? So now I have to go back. and sort of change what I sort of had going on, because there was a more interesting angle and a more interesting sort of shift that I could have gotten more drama and more conflict and more tension out of. So, you know, that has happened on a couple of occasions. I start out with one bad guy and find a better one halfway through, or I can sort of stick with the bad guy I sort of intended to be the bad guy and sort of ramp that up. So it's happened both ways. There's no rhyme or reason to it for me. I'm pretty sure there are other writers out there who are more proficient than I am, but that's kind of how my brain works, and that's kind of how I sort of do it.
So with the runner, or with runner, and you're dealing with a pretty kind of important theme as well as just the PI issue, and that is the condition of foster care, particularly for adolescents in our society. What brought you to want to write about that?
Well, I got the sort of germ of an idea for that one just from reading the newspaper and the number of runaways and how they sort of survive on the street, some of them sort of eschewing the resources that are out there to help them. And I thought that was an interesting thing to sort of want to write about. So I gave Cass a case, a client. The case is a runaway 15-year-old who is out there somewhere who has run away from her foster home. And I did a little bit of research. I don't like to do a lot of research because it just seems to me more like a writer math, and I hate math. So I just sort of like to create stories that are entertaining and fun and sort of move the pages along. But for this one, I thought it was important to sort of look at DCFS and the foster care system to see how it works, what kind of challenges they face, the sheer numbers of children that they serve, and then to sort of think of it and say, well, what would happen if this happened in this entire system? So this is a system as it's supposed to work, but what if this happened? And what if a child sort of fell through the crack at some point? How would she sort of face that challenge? I just sort of did enough to know what it was, know how it functioned, and then twisted it a little bit to sort of fit my purposes. So sheer numbers, it's just staggering how many children are actually out there on their own. just turning away from social services, things that are there to sort of help them and catch them before they fall off completely. And so I just wanted to talk a little bit about it. Not preaching, and it's not a textbook that I'm writing. It's entertainment. It's stuff for fun, supposedly. Yes.
It's interesting because I just had a conversation with a friend kind of when I was in the middle of reading this, who was talking about her daughter's job is she used to work in social services and trying to help the foster care, kids in foster care who were about to age out of the system and you know, help them make that transition. And she said, but very few of them made it successfully. And her job now is, I think she's with a nonprofit or something who's working with the homeless, a lot of whom were, you know, they're homeless young adults who were kids who aged out of the foster care system.
Yeah. And I think the sheer number of people that they have to sort of help. I mean, if you could see the workload, the caseload of these people who are doing this wonderful work. I mean, it's almost impossible for any one person or any one system to sort of catch everyone. And I don't think that population at large sort of understands the sheer volume of it. So I think we really have to do some serious, serious work on that.
You know, that is a really important point, that it's impossible for any one system to catch mm-hmm. everyone. Yeah. That we need multiple, you know, we need public, we need private, we need everything working
Absolutely.
Hand in hand.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Tracy Clark, author of Runner, a Chicago Mystery Series, Book 4. So, Tracy, why don't you read a little bit from the book for us?
Okay. I'm going to read a little bit from Chapter 3. This is at the point where Cass has sort of gotten her marching papers. She's met with Ramona Titus's mother, who wants her to help the police find Ramona. She's talked to the detective in charge at CPD. He doesn't have that much hope of finding the kid, limited resources and all that. And she's meeting for the first time sort of a freelance investigator, an ex-cop, who sort of helps out with cases like this on a freelance basis. So this is her coming to meet Frank Martini. There was at least a half inch of snow on my car by the time I made it outside. Right out the door, a mean and frigid wind socked me in the face like a brass-knuckled fist. I burrowed into my jacket, pushed into it, and ran for the car, skirting patches of slick ice, rock salt crunching underfoot. I dove for the car, slid inside, and started it up, flicking a stunned look at the weather readout on the dash. 7 below 0. Oh my God, I was going to die out here on these streets. Blowing on the tips of my fingers to get some of the feeling back, I watched ice on my windows loosen and melt, hoping I didn't have to get out and help the defroster along with the ice scraper from the back seat. Frosty the Snowman jingle-belled out of the speakers like sickly sweet sugar canes rolled in silver glitter, reminding me that Christmas was just a couple of weeks off and I hadn't bought a single gift yet. I punched the radio off, hoping out of sight, out of mind, actually worked, wishing that not hearing Frosty could somehow push Christmas back until I was ready for it. I wondered about Dolores Poole. Fostering troubled kids couldn't be an easy deal, though a lot of people did it well and for all the right reasons. Some kids did make it out on the other side. Look at Hogan. I wondered, too, about Ramona, moving through life, never engaging, barely leaving a mark, forced to fend for herself when her mother failed her. It was gray and cold and lonely out here. Where could she have gone? How was she surviving? As ice melted on my windshield and back window, I got out the slip of paper Hogan had given me and tried calling Poole, but the phone rang several times and never kicked into voicemail. I hung up, checked my watch. Almost 11. The only number I had for Shaw so far was his office number, and there was no point trying that on a Saturday. There was also no point in driving around aimlessly looking for Ramona. She'd been away from home for over a week now. She'd likely found a place to hold up or even managed to get out of the city altogether. It wasn't likely to happen upon her walking the streets, or at least I hoped I didn't. Street life was hard, unrepentant, It wouldn't take much for some scum to latch onto a runaway 15-year-old and turn her out. I dialed Frank Martini's number. Maybe he had something, and maybe he'd be willing to have a conversation. Martini, the man answered. Detective Frank Martini? Who's this? His voice was suspicious. I knew I didn't have long to explain myself, so I rattled through the info, my name, my purpose, my meet with Hogan, my past with the department, my bona fides, my entry card. When I finished, I waited for Martini to say something. He didn't for a few moments, and I wondered what he was thinking about. You know where Clancy's is? He asked. Clancy's was a cop bar not too far from where I was sitting. Sure, I said. Meet me there at noon. You're buying. He ended the call. I tossed the phone back into my bag. The windshield was clear. The car warmed up sufficiently. I took off for Clancy's. I wouldn't call Clancy's a restaurant, though they served foodish things to sop up the alcohol consumed at the messy bar. It was a place, a spot, with drinks and who cares what else. And it was as underwhelming as it has been the last time I'd seen it more than 5 years ago. It sat just off Western Avenue, a couple doors down from a hot dog joint, a Baskin-Robbins / Dunkin' Donuts, and a sad-looking Pizza Hut with the audacity to have a drive-thru. Clancy's was one story, frosted glass fronting it, beer signs and green shamrocks in the windows. There was no sign over the door or anywhere. Everybody in the neighborhood knew Clancy's. Cops knew Clancy's. Irish cops knew it better. There were three people in the place when I walked in, a white guy at a back table, a white guy at a front table, and a white guy behind the bar, who, when I asked for Martini, pointed me toward the back table white guy. I walked over. Frank Martini, I said. He looked me over. Cassandra Raines, P.I. He gestured for me to sit. I did. Hope you're hungry. Clancy's makes a mean shepherd's pie. Shepherd's pie, I thought, at Clancy's. Nope. I'll pass, I said, but thanks. Oh, come on. You're going to make me eat lunch alone? Heck yeah, I thought. It's Clancy's. I scanned the dingy dining area, which consisted of about 8 tables, most of them leaning. Nothing in the place looked as though it had been updated since the Reagan administration, including the sleepy-looking white guys sitting around me. They bake anything else? I asked. Martini's eyes widened. You don't like shepherd's pie? Not particularly. What's wrong with it? Nothing, I said, just not a fan. He put the menu down and stared at me. What are you a fan of, then? Clancy's McCheeseburgers, I asked. For a moment, there was complete silence at the table. Then Martini leaned back and began to laugh, hard, his face turning red and everything. I didn't see what was so funny about a cheeseburger, frankly. I was the one who should have been laughing at how going for shepherd's pie in this place. You really had to work hard to mess up a cheeseburger. Cheeseburger in an Irish place, Martini said, shaking his head, like ordering fish at a steakhouse. You Irish, Martini? On my mother's side, O'Shaughnessy's, from Dublin. I nodded, taking him in. Hogan told me he was retired, and he looked it. His thin hair was receding, almost completely gray, and he was going to flab around the middle. His eyes were blue with a touch of gray and deceptively keen behind all the friendly talk of burgers and pie. I noticed the nice watch on his wrist, much nicer than the everyday dad jeans and old man sweater he had on. Maybe the watch was a retirement gift, a memento from his brothers in blue to commemorate his 30 years on the job. Maybe I would have gotten such a watch if I hadn't turned in my badge 20 years too early. Martini wagged a pudgy finger at me. And anybody else would have eaten the pie to get in good with me. You ask for a cheeseburger. I grinned. And fries, I added. We ate lunch and talked cop. Martini had a lot of old stories. I did, too. He seemed like a nice guy. When we were done eating, we both pushed our plates away, and I got down to business. So, tell me about the Ramona Titus case, I said. What do I need to know?
Mm-hmm. And that was Tracy Clark reading from Runner. So, Tracy, a lot of times there seems to be a... one of the features of PI novels is a love-hate relationship with the police. Mm-hmm. Now, in this case, the police seemed to be welcoming her, or at mm-hmm. least some of them did. Mm-hmm. And why? Tell us like how that fits in the story and why you chose to go that way.
Well, I asked the police detectives when I sort of talked to them in person, sort of it whether or not they had sort of a relationship with PIs, and apparently they do not. this is not something that they're really concentrating a lot of time on. PIs are, no, they're like flies around buttermilk. No. So you know, I sort of had to sort of imagine that sort of connection. When she meets with the detective in charge of Ramona's case, he sort of recognizes her as sort of a fellow cop. I mean, she was a homicide detective like he is in the department. And so there's that sort of familiarity there. So there's that connection. As long as she doesn't get too close to what he's doing, he's fine with her actually being another set of feet on the ground. So that's great. Of course, she's also close to her ex-partner. When you are partners on a police force, any police force, that partner is your closest connection to survival and the success of your job. So those connections don't end when one of you leaves on for other greener pastures or whatever. So she's still got Ben close at hand. So she's sort of in and out, mostly out, but she has those sort of tethers to the department and can sort of ask and sort of present herself there and say, well, can I help you do this? Or what can you tell me about that? So I wanted that to sort of carry through from book to book. Sometimes it's easier than others for her to sort of make that connection. Other times it's not. She has a history with a particular detective, Faraday, that is not as easy as the other two connections are. And so it's good to sort of have all of those tension points to sort of draw on.
Wow. When you started writing these, did you originally intend for it to be a series, or when you started out, was it just a standalone?
Well, it was just one book when I started out. I had no idea what I was doing. I was teaching myself as I went along. And because the publishing business is so difficult and rejection letters pile in and pile in, as they piled in and I was finished with this particular manuscript, I just kept writing. I just kept writing. They didn't want this first book. I don't care. I'm going to write the second book. I have these characters already there. I may as well use them. So I wrote the second book, too. Got rejection letters back, rejection letters back. And so I started a third book. I am no, you know.
Some people would have given up at that point.
No, not me. It was a challenge. Oh, they're trying to kill me with rejection letters. They're trying to paper me with rejection letters. I don't care. The mule is my spirit animal, and I'm just going to continue on.
I love that.
I will not stop. Oh, you think those 10, 15 rejection letters are going to stop me? Heck no. I'm going to write book three, and we're going to see where that goes. But all the while, I'm sort of learning more. I'm learning a more effective ways to tell a story. I'm refining my characters from book to book to book. I'm learning to do it better. So when that first book sold, as I started querying again after many, many years, they said, well, we'll take this one. And I said, well, if you want that one, I've got two just like it sitting in my drawer, and you can take those too. And they did. So when I got that deal, that elusive golden ring after all these years of frustration and pulling my hair out, I had three finished, and they took all three. So then it was a matter of going back and revising it, refining it, tightening it, putting it in a shape that was good for publication, and then I was off to the races. So three books done already. I didn't have to worry too much about that. But then when they wanted another one and I was fresh out, you know, that's where the metal, that's where the rubber hits the road right there.
You had no remaining inventory.
Yeah, you got nothing in the drawer. I've given you all the three, blood, sweat, and tears that I sort of came up with. Now I have to come up with something totally new with the characters that I've sort of set for myself. And so that was probably, I think, book Runner was probably more difficult for me because I had to come up with everything from scratch and hope that
on
I didn't
a deadline.
Get... Yeah, on a deadline, exactly. So I had to sort of, you know, just buckle down and do it. So I'm really kind of proud of number four because that one sort of sprang out the last minute and I had to sort of come up with something really quickly. So I think it turned out well. Fingers crossed it does well.
So I'm assuming you still had a day job during this time.
Oh, yeah. So that was another extra. So I write. write from 5:30 to 8. That's my writing schedule, okay? I get up at 5:30. I write till 8. That's my time. 8 o'clock, I stop, and I have maybe 15 or 20 minutes of breakfast, Cheerios or whatever, and then I swivel over to my day job, and I edit for a living. So I'm doing op-eds and comic strips and puzzles and editorial cartoons, and that's what I do all day long. And if I can sort of muster it up and have the energy for maybe an hour or two at the end of the day, I will do it. If not, that 5:30 to 8 is my time for the day, and whatever comes out during that time is whatever comes out. So little by little, I was able to sort of limp along and sort of get this book done while still having other things to sort of worry about.
So those first three books that you wrote, one after another, what was the time span? This was over 3 years, 5 years, 10 years?
Well, nobody was out there waiting for anything. So
20 years?
Nobody. Actually, 20-some-odd years. I started writing Broken Places. In its early form, it had different iterations through the years. But I started starting that really seriously the second year of college. So that from that point until, 2018, when Broken Places came out, that's how long it took. And I'm no spring chicken, so that tells you how many years we're talking about.
Was it? So you wrote that book. You started sending it out. You started querying. You got rejection letters. Why did you start sending it out again 20 years later?
I was changing the whole time. Oh, everything changed. When I started out that book to begin with, that case was just a case. Somebody walked through her door with a problem. A priest at her local church was found dead. They think it's suicide. This person doesn't think it was a suicide. She thinks it's murder. And so she comes to Cass's office to have her look into it. Over the years, as I've sort of changed it and revised it and learned more about the craft of writing, that entire story changed, pivoted. Even Cass's backstory changed. Her name changed. Everything about that first draft of a crappy book changed. As I learned more, I went back and changed it and fixed it and sort of molded it and tightened it and did all of that fun stuff that they tell you to do in all the writing workshops. So it took that long between all of that fiddling around with it, thinking I'm finished, sending out query letters, getting the rejection back that tells me, nope, you're not finished, and then just continuing to sort of do it. When I got to the point where I thought I had known everything I knew about writing and I didn't know what else to change about it, that's when I sort of moved to the second book. I didn't know anything about that one. Maybe the second one is the one that's going to, I just kept doing it. I just kept doing it, all the while knowing that everything that I did was not wasted effort. The more I did it, it was like sort of priming a pump. The more I did it, the better I got. The better I got, the better my chances got. And then I sort of had this feeling that it was just a matter of time, that if I just stuck with it, that it was going to work out for me. I had no idea that that was going to be the case. I could have been completely wrong, but you'd have to sort of have that determination and that sort of confidence in yourself, even though you don't feel it a lot of the time, that this can happen for you. It has happened for others. It's just a matter of you writing a good book and presenting a good book, and you'll find your spot. So luckily, knock wood, it happened for me after 20 some odd years. And if it hadn't, I would still be there.
You'd still be writing them.
Writing the next one.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Tracy Clark, author of Runner.
Well, I was just wondering if all of your books are page turners like this one is.
I hope so. I would like to think they are. I certainly put the effort in.
Right. Well, this one definitely is. I mean, I just had to keep reading it because I just want to know what happened.
Awesome. I love hearing that.
And I think one thing that, I know that Mom appreciates about the book is that even though it's not always a pleasant subject, it's not graphic.
Mm-hmm.
It's.
I don't really go in for a lot of graphic. I think readers can sort of make that jump without me having to actually put blood and guts and brain matter on the page. Some writers are good at that. I'm not. I'm kind of squeamish myself. and in Runner particularly, when you're sort of talking about children and at-risk children, you don't want to sort of get sort of mired down in, you know what I mean? I didn't want to do that. She's a PI. She's not a psychiatrist or a psychologist. Her motivation is to help. And I think I sort of told enough in such a way that you can sort of imagine what might happen without me actually having to say, this is what happens. This is what happened to this 14-year-old, 15-year-old kid. And isn't it terrible? I mean, we can sort of get all of that without me actually having to get too graphic about it.
Well, we know what the possibilities are because we read about them all the time. And, you know,
exactly.
And
yep.
So it's refreshing to me not to have that in this book. It really was. I appreciate that.
And that's for me, too. I mean, it's a dark enough subject without having to get really dark about it. So.
Mm-hmm. Now, Tracy, you mentioned that in book one, you know, a priest died, and in Runner, we've got, and I'm assuming throughout the series, Cass's best friend is a nun, mm-hmm. or one of her best friends is a nun, and there's another nun character in here. Mm-hmm. So, is that a kind of a common theme? And is that, you know, is there something in your background that makes you write about priests and nuns in this?
Well, I didn't intend to put Sister Marion in Runner. She just popped up. When in book one, Cass loses someone very close to her who happens to be a priest. She has sort of a weird childhood. Mother died and father sort of took off and left her with her grandparents when she was 12. So this priest, this parish priest, is her sort of de facto father figure. And when her case opens up and something terrible happens, she's sort of left sort of wandering in the wilderness, so to speak, without any guidance or any kind of, you know, family. She sort of cobbled a family together for herself, you know, and so that sort of follows her through book to book. Sister Marion just popped up on that van as I needed her. And as the more I wrote her and the more I thought about her, she's sort of like a stand-in for Pop in book one. She sort of lost that connection and then has miraculously found it again three books later. And so whether or not that's going to be an easy alliance, whether or not she's going to sort of latch on to this curmudgeon-y nun and sort of... You know, it still remains to be seen, but the connection is there for potential, and we'll see how close they get, or, you know, Cass might just decide to sort of, nah, it's too much for me, and she sort of walks away. Cass has her flaws. One of those is sort of finding people to sort of depend upon, so we'll see. We'll see how that goes.
So are you Catholic?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, I forgot that part of the... Yeah, yeah, I am. I was 16 years of Catholic school, grade school, high school, college. I live two blocks from my neighborhood parish. In fact, my parish church is the church in Broken Places where the bodies are found. I'm sitting in Mass, as you do, on a Sunday, and your mind wanders, as it does. And I look over at the confessional, and I see in my mind's eye a foot sticking out of it. And I said, isn't that interesting? And then I look at the altar steps, marble, all nice and shiny, and I see a blood pool sort of expanding on it. And I said, isn't that interesting? And so that's how Broken Places started. So I'm imagining those two bodies in my church, sitting there on a Sunday. And then, of course, I have to figure out what else happens, but how they got there. So, yeah, that's how that book started.
You know, we have kind of a concept, a stereotype, I think, of African-American Christian religiosity being Baptist and mm-hmm. not Catholic. Is there a large contingent of African Americans in the Catholic Church?
I think there's a large contingent of converts to the Catholicism, which is great. I mean, all religion is good. Believing in God, fantastic. That's for you. I don't care where people come from, but the Catholic religion, you know, it's okay. I mean, 16 years, there's some things that I would probably change about it. Personally, I would like to see female priests. We'll see whether or not we get there. But, you know, it's sort of a solace in that. For me, it is. Other people might have different experiences, but I count myself as a Catholic, not maybe a close Catholic. I don't go to Mass every Sunday. I probably should, with the thoughts running around in my mind. But, you know, it's there. It's there as a foundation. So whoever comes, the doors are open. Join us.
Oh, that's very nice. Mom, you have any comments on that?
Well, I personally, I never felt that because I had been involved in church goings on forever, music and everything else, that I never felt second class. Did I, mm-hmm. you know? And so, but that's
oh,
just
so
my
you're speaking as a Catholic woman. That
yeah right. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, we have some connection. My nephew, mom's grandson, is a priest mm-hmm. and was actually ordained at St. Peter's, and we were able to go for that, or his ordination to the diaconate was at St. Peter's in Rome. So mm-hmm. that was kind of cool.
Nice. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
You're right to the
yeah.
source there.
Yeah. Yeah.
I know. I remember how surprised I was when nuns stopped wearing habits and you said sort of regular clothes. The kids just sort of watched them walk by in their regular clothes like normal people, and our mouths were agape. I mean, it was just a you know, just a wondrous thing. I mean, where did these people come from? I mean, there were people. You mean there were people under there? You know, so yeah, it was quite a shock.
Yeah, yeah. So I notice, you know, you are a member of a number of mystery writers organizations, mm-hmm. and it seems like detective and mystery writers really sort of stick together more than a lot of other genres.
I think so. It's kind of like a family, really. I think we're sort of bonded by the fact that this is a difficult thing. Writing is difficult. You're sitting in a room by yourself. There's nobody standing over your shoulder telling you how to do it. You're pulling your hair out most of the time, trying to figure out how to get out of this plot hole that you've created for yourself. You know, and the community is filled with people in the same boat. Everybody knows the tensions and the stresses of writing and writing fiction, especially crime fiction. So we sort of bond together for protection and security. We commiserate and we give advice and tips and we root each other on. I think that was a biggest surprise for me when I sort of actually stepped into the writing community with my first book, to know that everybody was so close and so encouraging. And I love it. I just love everything about it. So I joined when I got my first book deal, Sisters in Crime, Writers, Mystery Writers of America, all of it. I just jumped in both feet. Here I am. Here I am, world. It took me 20 years or so to get here, but here I am now. And it's been absolutely fun the entire time. I haven't found a bad apple in the bunch so far, so and I'm hoping I don't find one. I don't think they're there.
Oh, that's great.
Oh, great.
Are they having any in-person conventions yet?
Well, we've got the big world convention, BaoshaCon, in the latter part of August in New Orleans. So we'll see if anything happens before then to stop us from going. But I think we should have a good showing in August.
And what's that called again?
It's called BaoshaCon. It's a world mystery conference.
BaoshaCon?
BaoshaCon, yeah.
BaoshaCon.
Yeah, so we'll see if that comes away. I think it will. I think everybody's pretty confident that we're past the worst of it. At least we hope so. And we can't wait to all get together again and hit the bar and tell interesting stories.
And tell me about the Sue Grafton Memorial Award.
Yeah, that was a surprise, actually. A pleasant one. I'm smiling about it. It's been, what, a year and a half or so. I think it's a pretty good thing. I met Sue Grafton just once, early on when I was still trying to sort of teach myself how to write. I read in the paper that she was going to be signing, I think, one of her early books, A or B, down at the bookstore on Wabash. So I took the bus down there by myself because I couldn't get anybody else to go. So I went and I stood in line and I got my book signed. And now to sort of wait those decades later, after all that stress and whatever, to actually get an award named for her is just mind-boggling. I can't believe it actually happened. I'm glad it did. If I do nothing else in this entire writing career, that will be the highlight. And and it's all good. It's
well,
great.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you so much.
And, of course, you're compared to Sue Grafton and Sarah Paretsky's. You know, I'm reading from the Library Journal Review, fans of Sue Grafton's Kinsey Millhone or Sarah Paretsky's V.I. Warshawski, I don't know if that's how you pronounce it, but Warshawski, will welcome Cass Rains to their ranks. So that
nuts.
Must have made you feel pretty good.
That's nuts. That's nuts. I can't believe that either. Now I'm getting nervous now.
Yeah, and so we'll get to say we knew you when.
Right.
Yeah, right.
So do you think that you'll, I mean, some of these authors, they, how many books did Sue Grafton publish? Did
well,
she make it
to
Z?
No, she got to Y,
to
one
Y.
Book away.
Oh, my.
You know, so still heartbreaking. I miss her. I miss Kinsey Millhone. Yeah, she got to Y. But, you know, most of these writers are books and books ahead of me. I'm only on, what, 4.5? Some people have 26 books, 25 books, 18. You know, it's my, I can't believe it. I can't imagine writing 18 books on anything.
I know. And a lot of these kind of crime writers, also like romance writers, too, they write mm-hmm. 1 to 2 books a year.
Yeah, yeah.
Can you see yourself doing that?
Heck no. One book a year. It's all I can handle, and not even then. I mean, it's hard work.
Yeah,
it's a heavy lift. So I all the respect and all the honor to them if they can do it.
At what point would you quit your day job and just focus on writing detective stories?
Well, I would love to do that. When I imagined myself writing, I always imagined myself just sort of sitting in a room like Hemingway, the windows open, me sitting on the porch with my little legal pad and pen, and that's all I had to do.
And your mojito. But,
yeah, but I think the publishing has changed over the years. I think it's different. I think very few people sort of have that luxury of writing only. There's always something that has to sort of come with it in order for you to sort of make a living, unless you're like Stephen King or, I don't know, J.K. Rowling or something. But the rest of us are just out there sort of tapping away and doing all the other 500 million things we have to do to sort of sustain ourselves. But that's my dream, to sort of one day have nothing to do but write all day long, with no other, you know, distractions or comic strips or anything, sort of begging for my attention.
Do you think, though, that you would be as productive? You know, you have that limited time. If you had
yeah.
all day, would you actually write more words?
I would hope so. I would like to say I would like to say yes.
Yes.
But I know if Judge Judy is on and my sort of mind wanders, that I'll probably be sitting up there eating ginger snaps and drinking ginger ale and with my feet up, knowing I have pages to do. But I'll get to it eventually, and I never do. So you're probably right. I probably need that other part of it.
Do you ever experience writer's block?
No, I don't really. There are times when I stop writing maybe for a day or a half a day because I have something to think through. If I've sort of created a problem for myself and I know that it, maybe I've taken a left turn in terms of plot where I should have taken maybe a right turn, I have to stop and sort of try to figure out where I went wrong, go back, and just sort of figure out how to go. So there are writer pauses, I think, not block, just pauses to sort of get the idea straight and figure out what I should be doing or where it needs to go and then sort of go. So occasionally I write really fast or get to a point where I have no idea what I'm going to do next and I stop for a bit and then when I figure out where that needs to be, then I go again. So hopefully before that 5:30 rolls around the next morning, when I have to sit in the chair and do what I need to do.
Now, when you're writing, like, first draft, do you write straight? Yeah, I mean, I know you say you pause, but do you go back and rewrite things at the time, like, as you're writing, or are you pretty much on a straight flow through and then go back and do the rewriting?
Well, I usually go back. You're not supposed to. That's the prevailing wisdom, that you're just supposed to keep going forward until you finish. The point is to sort of finish that first draft, because that's what you then have to work on. That's what you sort of mold together and create a story out of. I, however, cannot go forward if I know I've left the mess, last chapter. If I know that I've taken a wrong turn, if I don't know that I haven't, then it's fine. I can go forward and do whatever and figure out later that I did. But if I know I've made a wrong turn, and then everything that comes after that doesn't feel right, because I know I'm going to have to change it because I made that right turn down there, and I know I did. So I have to go back and fix it, and then I can go forward. I can't go forward if I know.
Well, that makes perfect sense.
A trail of mess.
Yeah, because particularly in this type of writing, if you went forward, mm-hmm. everything you wrote after that, you might have to scrap.
Right. It's like sort of dominoes sort of falling down on each other. You sort of mess up, and when it is misaligned, the whole thing just goes up. So you're supposed to go forward until you finish. I cannot. I go back and forward and back and forward, and I do that for 300 and some odd pages. That's just my process. That's just how I do it.
Well, thank God for word processing, right?
Yeah,
for computers.
Exactly. You got it.
Now, you talked about how over these years you taught yourself to write. Mm-hmm. If you had it to do over again, would have, like, writing workshops or MFA programs, would that have, do you think, gotten you to that point faster?
Well, all along I was taking writing classes. I started taking writing classes in high school, anything they offered, creative writing, journalism 101. I continued that through college and grad school. Any writing course they offered, I took, whether or not it was related to fiction or not. All of that I've considered knowledge and sort of feeding that memory bank and putting that in there. All along I did that. I also attended writing workshops that were in my area. I did that every year until I sort of, they went away. I mean, they just sort of stopped.
Yeah.
But I went there. All-day sessions on pacing and character development. So I did all of that early work because I knew that this is what I wanted to do. And the more I knew about it, the more I could sort of call upon when I actually sat down at that laptop by myself, the better off I felt I would be. So all along I did that. So I think when I got to the point where I was actually writing, I'm writing a book, here it is, I had that information in there. So I was sort of ahead of the game, not quite there, still had a lot to learn, but at least I had that foundation. So yeah, I did everything I could think of to do. And even when it didn't work or wasn't working for those 20 some odd years, I was confident that I had enough information that I could eventually find out what it was, whatever that it was that I was missing. And bring it around. So I had that confidence and that stubbornness and that unwillingness to give up. Those rejection letters now are like a badge of courage for me. If I had not been as focused and as determined as I was back then, I would probably be doing something else right now. You know, but it became sort of like Game of Thrones. It was between me, you know, me and the agents and editors out there who were guarding the gate and not letting me in. And then now it becomes a battle of wills. Who's going to give in first? Who's going to, and it wasn't going to be me. I was confident that it was not going to be me. So somebody was going to let me in, maybe not this year, maybe not 5 years from now, but eventually I would be in there, and then they're going to have to sort of deal with me. But yeah.
Well, congratulations for making it in and getting to the Iron Throne.
That's right. They tried to kill me when I came back.
Did you ever consider self-publishing?
Not really, because I didn't sort of think that much about that part of it. My battle was with myself, with learning how to tell a story, with getting better at character and world building and all of that. That's my head was down, and I was really focused on craft and how to do it and what I needed to learn to get it done. I didn't learn about self-publishing and promoting and marketing and all the rest of that stuff until I got actually broken through the gate and slayed the dragon and, and took a look around at the industry itself, because now you realize that now it's a business, right?
Yeah,
are just one tiny cog in an entire system that has publicists and agents and editors and cover artists and all the rest of that fun stuff that you don't even think about when you're sort of trying to figure out how to do stuff. So that became the revelation, that this is a business. They conduct it like a business. And you have to sort of do your part. You have to write the book. You have to promote the book. You have to champion the book. You have to hold your book by the hand and run it through. Just find your readers and, you know, just really talk about yourself, which I find kind of difficult to do. I'm basically a shy person, introverted. So to be out there, to put yourself out there with this book, holding this book up, like, hey, look at me, like your P.T. Barnum trying to sort of talk people into a tent or something. That was the education, and that was the sort of thing I had to learn.
Well, I think it's a really good point, and you allude to one of the downsides of self-publishing is that books maybe get published that aren't really ready and that aren't as good as they could be. And that could actually be a detriment to the long-term writing career of that author.
And the flip side of that is there are some writers out there who are self-published who are really doing gangbusters.
Yes.
I mean, and they are experts at marketing and promoing and putting their things out there. Some of them are even doing their own covers. I mean, I really have a great deal of respect and honor for them. I mean, they are really doing the job. There's some things that probably need more work. We can say that about the published stuff too. All writers are the same. We're all sort of traveling that same road, and we never get to a point where everything's going to be perfect. You can always sort of look back, even at the books that are published for me now, I can probably look at them again and find 5 or 6 places in each one of those where I would have liked to take maybe another turn or another pivot, where I could have done something a little bit better. So it's all process. It's all writing. It's all learning and getting better and tightening and all that fun stuff. So I don't think you ever get to a point, writers do, where you know everything. You've gotten to the mountaintop. And there's nothing else to learn.
Well, Tracy,
you can always learn something else.
That's great words of wisdom for all writers, new and experienced. And we're out of time. So thank you so much for being with us. And, Mom, do you have some closing words?
Well, quite a few, actually, probably. But, you know, children without a home is a sad reality in today's world. And that's why places like Covenant House is so important. Mm-hmm. And if you have a chance to support them, They take these children in off the street, give them a home, help them to survive, and be ready to go into the world with the necessary skills when the time comes. And I applaud them and applaud anybody who helps a person who is homeless, whether it's a child or an adult.
All right. Yep, I agree.
Yeah. Well, thank you for being with us, Tracy.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
And see you all next week on Writers' Voices.
Bye-bye.